Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today, I'm so pleased to have Dale Peck here in the studio. Welcome, Dale.
Thank you.
Dale is in town. He's going to be reading tomorrow at the University of Michigan Museum of Art, fondly called UMA. And so that's Thursday, October 10th at 5:10 p.m. In the Helmut Stern Auditorium. And you're also going to be doing a Q&A earlier in the day at noon at the Art Museum.
The Q&A is at the Art Museum. The reading is at a bookstore, right?
You know what?
I was looking into the studio
Greg is giving us the nod. So you know what? By the time we'll say it again later in the show. So stay tuned for the real facts.
I should know that, but I just let for some to take me there.
Or the guests, like where I printed it off from the event website. Well, anyway, we'll see what happens here. Well, Dale is in town and we've got an hour to talk. We've got many of your books, not all of them, but almost many of them here on the table.
I've got 12, so there are 7 missing.
And we've got one ebook too.
We've got one ebook. Yes, at least one.
At least. Oh, okay, great. Right. Yeah, because that's the beauty.
I got some PDFs. I got some manuscripts. I got a lot here.
So we might even have like a world premiere
We could. You never know. I've got 2 new books, and you know, coming out.
Let's do that. Okay. Let's do that. Okay. So stay tuned, folks, because lots to come. But first, Dale Peck's bio. Dale Peck published his first novel, Martin and John, which the New York Times called a brilliant debut, in 1993. 2 more novels followed.
I was only 4.
Child prodigy. Now that you mention it.
Just 29 now.
He's looking good, folks. But on your book, Martin and John, people like Edmund White was saying, this touchingly young writer will have a great future. You know, all of the blurbs are very much like this young man.
Yeah.
Prodigious talent.
I was a baby and I looked like a baby too. But Carson McCullers beat me by 2 years. So
yes.
Yeah. I mean, Heart is a Lonely Hunter came out when she was 23. So, and that's a really
Which
great
is
book.
Kind of Isn't it always that book is somehow always in, no matter where you go in the country, every bookstore's top 10 or something if they're doing, when they have 100 books.
You know, I
hadn't
read it in about 15 years and I taught it last year and it holds up. It's fantastic. It's so great. Yeah.
So a shout out to Carson McCullers.
Word.
And then this is also, since we're doing these blurbs, Michael Cunningham said, and a voice like an angel chewing on broken glass.
You want a good story for that? So Michael and I shared a publisher at the time at Farrar Stress. So they just called him up for the blurb, and he dictated it over the phone. And the person who wrote it down wrong initially. And instead of writing down an angel chewing on broken glass, they wrote an angel chewing on rope and glass, which was how the first edition was printed. So if you have a first edition of Martin and John at home, look at your dust jacket, and if it says rope and glass, you have a very rare copy of that book. And Michael told me this, and he said, you know what really pisses me off is that it's kind of better.
Well, because it's more curious, like mysterious.
Yeah.
Like,
he said, I'm not sure what it means, but it's kind of better. But I'll take the real one, too.
The happy accidents. Yeah. I forgot about your bio. Well, let's keep doing the bio like this, Dale. Okay. Like we can kind of
All right. In other words, I'll keep interrupting.
That would be great.
That's only one book, 12 more. I mean, that's the hour.
We're going to do this. Two more novels followed. The Law of Enclosures, which was adapted into a feature film by John Grayson, starring Sarah Polley and Diane Ladd.
Speaking of shout-outs, I'm sorry, John Grayson actually is being held in an Egyptian prison right now. He was going over there to scout some locations for a documentary that he's filming, and he and his photographer were arrested, for taking insightful pictures or something like that. And they've They've been in jail for a month now, and it was just announced that they're being held for at least another 90 days. So, like,
how can they already have decided at least another 90 days? Like, what?
Well, I think partly, you know, it was during the, you know, the sort of flare up of riots that happened about a month ago, and yes. I think partly because they just arrested hundreds and hundreds of people, and you know, the wheels of justice are not exactly spinning very quickly right now over there. So, it's just one of those things. Like, we'll get back to you, and I mean, that could be just trying to scare them. It could be trying to scare other people, something, you know, just trying to sound tough. But, you know, as with everybody else, I'm keeping up with it through their Facebook page. And the last I'd heard was that, you know, they said they were going to be held for at least another 90 days on suspicion of inciting riot or something, you know, crazy like that. So if John Grayson with an E, and if you care, you can write a letter, or there, you know, if you go to his Facebook page, there's a link that you can click to write a letter to the Egyptian government and say, let him go.
Oh, yeah. I hope, hopefully Amnesty International is also.
Yeah. I mean, he's, you know, pretty well connected and well known. So, you know, I definitely, I mean, I found out not because I haven't kept in touch with him for at least a decade, but just because, you know, it just started the story itself. Like, it was a new story started showing up. So I should think that they're aware.
And I feel like maybe you can clarify this, Dale, when John Stewart, I feel like wasn't there someone, was he just making a film about someone who was also wrongfully imprisoned?
John Stewart from The Daily Show?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay. Okay, never mind. Well, I digress.
We haven't even made it into the second book. Oh, we've just gotten into
We're almost there because I'm at the conjunction and. Mm-hmm. Right. So this is the second novel. Okay, and now it's time to say goodbye.
Number three.
Other books include a memoir cum novel, What We Lost, which was overshadowed by the attention bestowed on his book of literary criticism, Hatchet Jobs, and its most notorious review, that of Rick Moody's The Black Veil. Peck has published two novels for children, Drift House and The Lost Cities, and one young adult novel, Sprout, and a literary thriller, Body Surfing. Peck lives in New York City with his husband, Lou Peralta. And Peck, it sounds so weird to call you your third person.
You can call me Dale.
And Dale Peck teaches in the graduate writing program of the New School. Thanks again for being here, Dale.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
It's good to see you. So Body Surfing, a literary thriller, is that... I don't know.
I don't know exactly what a literary thriller means. I think they just put the word literary in front of it just because I'm a literary writer. I mean, Body Surfing is a book that I had a lot of fun writing.
Is that why you're wearing an ascot?
I'm just wearing a fleece with a t-shirt. Kidding. Yeah. I got
you're smoking
it.
Jacket.
You're making a joke. See, I'm being very literal now.
But people at least know what you're wearing now.
It was very funny when I published Body Surfing, which I just essentially wrote because, you know, I needed a paycheck. And, you know, I enjoyed writing it and I like the book quite a bit. But to me, it's just a thriller. And, you know, the idea that it's literary or something, you know, it's I think that term is... you know, has been so bastardized. Am I not violating any FCC rules by saying that?
I think you're okay.
You know, enough as it is. And definitely when you, I mean, this is a book, you know, there are sort of, you know, evil spirits and, you know, as I sort of explained, you know, like when you write a thriller, basically you write the scene, what actually has to happen. And then you either add a car chase, a fight, sex.
And that's,
you know,
what makes it literary. No, the thriller.
That's what makes it a thriller. Yes. You know, if you strip out the car chases and the sex and the violence, then you have like, you know, 50 pages, you know, is left. So, yeah, I, you know, if you want to call it a literary thriller because the sentences are grammatically correct, then you can do that. But, you know, mostly I was just thinking, this is, you know, this will earn more money than another depressing book about, you know, an introverted gay man.
Now, and is that the upcoming book that we can look forward to, Dale? Because you mentioned you had a couple.
I have two books coming out. The first is a memoir. It's a memoir and a collection of essays put together. And actually, when I get back to New York City Friday night, my editor and I are supposed to get together and decide whether or not we're just going to do a standalone memoir, which is very short, only about 100 pages, or whether we'll do also some of these collected essays to go with it. And it's a very six of one, half dozen of the other kind of thing. It's a more elegant book if it's just a memoir. It's a more complete book if it's, you know, includes the essays. But it's essentially, it's a portrait of you know, both my youth, but also my years when I was in ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, and the last, it's kind of the second half of the first half of the AIDS epidemic. You know, if you divide AIDS in half into like 30 years, the first 15 years were the years before the protease inhibitors and combination therapy came around, and this is sort of the last half of that period, which was really, you know, a very dark period. There was no light at the end of the tunnel. Things just kind of suddenly changed. And so it was a very dark period. But at the same time, I was, you know, 19, 20, 21, 22, you know, in college, graduating from college, living in New York City. I joined ACT UP, and, you know, in my mind, ACT UP is sort of, you know, the most effective political organization, you know, between the 1960s, you know, between the Black Panthers and MoveOn, you know, and it was a very small group, unlike those groups, which are massive. Or, well, I don't know if Black Panthers was massive, you know, MoveOn, which is a huge
MoveOn. Yeah.
This was a small group of a few thousand people. And I just really, I take no credit. I didn't think it up. I just happened to be a member of this group. And it was an incredible experience. And, you know, so writing about sex, writing about, you know, politics and all that is, you know, that's this book, which is called Visions and Revisions.
And would this be a good time to mention, because John Ware was on the program a couple of years ago, and he told the story of you both going to CBS News and interrupting Dan Rather.
Yes.
In ACT UP.
It became a kind of joke that ACT UP was organized into these smaller subsets or cells called affinity groups, which is basically a small group of, you know, maybe 20 or 30 people, every one of whom kept track of the other, you know, members, just because, you know, in New York City, there were several thousand members. And so when you were doing political, you know, work that might involve getting arrested, you wanted people keeping track of you. So we had a group called Action Tours. I take no credit. I was just a member. And it just so happened that, you know, the only reason why I did the CBS action was because I was willing to get arrested. And people weren't sure what the charges were. They were afraid it might be, you know, a felony. It was the fourth day of the Gulf War. So people were, you know, like a little nervous about like what would happen. We'd been planning the action for months, but then the war broke out and, you know, we just decided to go ahead with
it anyway. And that changed what you said.
Well, yes. Money for AIDS. Fight AIDS, not Arabs. You know, yes. We did say that. But, you know, it was, you know, looking back on it, you know, now, the space of 23 years or something like that, I'm mostly jealous that John got on the air and I didn't.
Because his head sort of bobs up.
His head
can
does
look
get
on the YouTube.
He's the only one who got on camera before we were tackled and all that. However, I did go to school with somebody who was an associate producer on the show. And he, when my book came out, he gave it to Dan Rather. When Martin and John came out, he gave it to Dan Rather and said, you know, this was the person who, I believe he said, rudely interrupted, which is what Dan Rather said on air.
Which was trying to diminish it in some way that it was impossible for him to do. And it just, by saying that, it seemed ridiculous.
There's only one other time in history that a live news broadcast has actually been interrupted. So the sort of precedent for what you're supposed to do in that situation, I think, you know, that's not what a newscaster who sits, you know, in a chair is trained to do. So that was how he covered. But it was, you know, I mean, this is essentially what we were kind of protesting, which is the sort of noblesse oblige, you know, of the station, this idea that, you know, one, you know, report a week was enough about AIDS at a, you know, particular moment when, you know, infection rates were spiraling out of control and death rates were really spiraling out of control. And, you know, it was this monumental story and, you know, it wasn't, you know, being given its due place, we felt, you know, at the time on the air. So it's kind of unsurprising that he would say something like that.
Because nothing was maybe on the prompter to say.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's take a short break and we'll be right back. Today on the program, Dale Peck is here. You've got Living Writers. Greg is in the engineering chair. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be right back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, glad you did. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. Today, Dale Peck is here. Dale, thanks for picking the songs for today's show.
Thank you for asking me. It was very daunting. I like music a lot. So we were just listening to, you know, the most famous aria from Carmen, which I apologize for my French, but I believe it is L'amour est un oiseau rebelle, love is a rebellious bird, which I picked because in the new book that we were just talking about, Visions and Revisions, one of the passages in there talks about how when I was a senior in college, I found a letter in a used copy of Carmen, and it was a 7-page love letter from 1965, from a Frenchman to an American, an American boy, you know, male to male. It was just totally by chance. I worked in a used bookstore and we got this consignment of records in and I had to clean them all because they were very dirty. And then it sort of later emerged that the person who had received whose consignment it was, who had received the letters, was this man named Gino Pistercchio, who was a Warhol superstar, a very minor superstar. He's the boy in the pool with he's the boy on the bed with Edie Sedgwick in Beauty Number 2. He also scored the posthumous Edie Sedgwick movie, the movie that came out after she died, but she stars in. He scored that movie as well, and who's sort of early player of the Moog synthesizers, Gino Pistercchio. But, you know, I was 18, 19 years old, and I found this letter, you know, in a copy of Carmen, and it is the most beautiful love letter you've ever read in your life. But at the time, I had no idea who the person was, because I just, the letter was addressed to Gino, there was no name on it, and my boss didn't remember where the records had come from. All he remembered was that the guy had been, you know, involved with the factory, and that he had been, had been an actor and had done some music and all that, and then over the course of the next 5 years, I was able to track down who he was, so.
Did you give him back the letter?
Oh, he died. That's why we got got the records.
That's why they came in.
Yes.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So, I wrote an essay about it a few years ago that was in Harper's, and then I adapted the essay as part of this
called,
book.
What was that called, Dale?
It's called Same As That, which is a sort of pun on Samizdat. The first time I ever heard someone say Samizdat, I thought they were saying same as that, because I didn't know what the word was, and I was too embarrassed to admit that I didn't know it was. So that it's called Same As That.
I don't think I know what the word is.
Samizdat is, hidden writings from the Soviet era that were censored and, you know, kind of, you know, circulated posthumously, but surreptitiously. A very famous piece of Samizdat is, you know, the Master Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov,
okay.
But also a lot of protest, you know, writings and, you know, reactions against the regime.
And you found this letter, well, going back to your story, Dale, yeah. Like when you were 19, when you were working at...
Maybe I was 20.
So you've been to... Yeah. You were in Drew College in New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
and working in a used
bookstore. I worked at a fabulous used bookstore called the Chatham Bookseller, which I still visit whenever I'm in the area.
Long may it prosper.
It's just so cheap. I mean, still want to, you know, walk in there and get 50-cent paperbacks and $3 hardcovers. It's so nice. And just going through these records, and I found this letter, and, you know, it was on Onion Skin, 7 pages long, and it was very hard to decipher. It took me like just 3 or 4 days to actually work out the whole letter. And I kid you not, it's just the most amazing letter you've ever read in your life, and it's full of love. It's also a little bit creepy. It's very obvious that the writer Jean Gabriel is older than Gino, you know, and he's kind of sort of trying to browbeat him into coming to be with him and all that. And, you know, it's very intoxicating. You know, it's almost as, you know, it reads a little bit like a short story. Like he refers to things, and what happened was they spent some time together, a week or two, and then suddenly, like a la Casablanca. Gino ran away from him at a train station and disappeared for 2 years. And then after 2 years, he wrote a letter to Jean Gabriel apologizing for abandoning him, you know, and something like that. And now Gino was replying to that letter, sort of beseeching him to come to Europe where he'll buy a convertible and they'll drive through Europe and all that. And talking about how Gino was working as a model. He was very beautiful, Mr. Pistercchio. It's just kind of gorgeous. The whole letter is in the book.
It is. Okay, that was yeah. My next question. And then did you translate it from the French, or was he writing in
English?
Oh, no,
he wrote in
English.
Gino? He wrote in English, okay. Thank God, yes.
And so Had you ever talked to Davy Rothbart about the found? Because you know Davy Rothbart, who does Found magazine, and he does.
I do not
that,
know this.
He would love a story like this. But
I wish I hadn't written it for.
Well, no. Well, you found it, Finders Keepers. Yeah. I mean, to be
no,
fair.
I just wish I hadn't given it to someone else. I'd given it to a place that was into that. Although I love Harper, so I'm glad they published it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's right. Spread the found gems around, yeah. Right? And so now that, let's bring us more up to the present. So when I was researching you, Dale, one of your latest novels that's out with Mischief and Mayhem,
right.
the Garden of Lost and Found, mm-hmm. You've got some great YouTube clips online where
directed by my husband.
Wonderful. Yes. And so where you're doing a tribute to Bob Dylan.
Oh, yeah.
And
with tell
us a little bit about...
For those of you who know the song Subterranean Homesick Blues, which is a super famous song, which of course includes the very famous phrase, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. But it also, the video for that song, if you could call it that, it was a short film at the time, is hugely famous. And unfortunately, most people know it through knockoffs without realizing that it's citing Bob Dylan at this point. But it's the video with the placards where, you know, he stands up there. He doesn't actually lip sync. He has not all the lyrics, but sort of, you know, pop words from the lyrics written on a group of cards, and he's tossing them by while Allen Ginsberg and who's the third person? It's Allen Ginsberg and somebody else are horsing around in the background while he's doing this.
Could we say Gregory Corso? Who knows?
That might be right. Like the very first time I actually saw that technique was in the In Excess video.
Yes.
From the 1980s, and I had no idea it was a Bob Dylan song, you know, until many years later. And it's apparently been done, you know, quite a few times. But in the video, so Mischief and Mayhem is a publishing company that I co-founded with a group of friends. Among other things, our goal, we are kind of on hiatus right now for various reasons. But our goal, you know, I hate to say this for all of you people who love bookstores out there, but our goal was to be a direct to the reader publisher.
Publisher to reader.
But to cut out the bookstore and to cut out the bookstore markup as well. I think just, you know, in the age of the internet, bookstores are, you know, probably an unnecessary anachronism. Well, I shouldn't say that. My own feeling, you know, is that...
Because my heart was just like...
Yeah. Ugh. In the next 10 or 20 years, I firmly believe that both Amazon and Barnes & Noble and the various big chains are going to be out of book selling, unless Amazon has, of course, taken over book publishing, which may happen. But I believe that, you know, fairly quickly, publishers are just going to be selling their books directly to readers at substantially lower prices than they do now, because there won't be the 50% bookstore markup. However, I think that that what will actually then happen is that independent bookstores are going to make a comeback, because, you know, when you walk into a Barnes and Noble, you just walk into a warehouse full of books, and, you know, there's no taste there, there's no curatorial approach or something like that, and so you're just overwhelmed, and there's still a certain kind of reader who wants recommendations, and they'll get some of those recommendations from, you know, the kinds of magazines that they like to read. But, you know, there's also something nice about walking into a bookstore that only has, say, you know, 10,000 books as opposed to 300,000 books on its shelves, and, you know, knowing the taste of the person who's picked out those books, so that, you know, when you walk to the fiction section, you can assume that, you know, there's a much better chance that you might like one of these books that you've never heard of, just because you trust the taste. So I actually think independent bookstores are going to make a comeback. Although I think the time is going to be really hard for them in the interim until we get there. But I hope and pray, you know, that Amazon and Barnes & Noble are completely shut out of the, you know, book selling business, because I think both of them just have such a homogenizing, you know, effect. One of our partners, actually, we partner with a small press called one of whose founders is Colin Robinson, who wrote a really great piece, you know, on the sort of myth of Amazonian inclusivity. And the fact is that the more choices that consumers are presented with, including book buyers, whom you think of as very smart and savvy, the more choices you present them with, the fewer choices they make, the more they tend to standardize towards, you know, the same books. If you sell someone 10,000 books, they might buy, you know, 100 of them. If you sell somebody 1 million books, they might buy 50 of them.
Oh, that's
Yeah,
that's kind of interesting. Then.
Right.
So the bookstores maybe is it's more of a community space in
right.
the future.
Exactly. Exactly.
And something more particular to yeah. communities when we're trying to make a. Like,
I mean,
that's
our hope.
In you know? More individual. Okay. Yeah. Well, because I was listening to your talk for Penn.
Right.
Your Penn
right.
talk, May 2011.
Right.
Nice talk.
Thank you. Thank you.
And here you're sort of bringing the publishing industry like to task in some ways. And here you say,
well, I think they've really
Amazon
dropped the ball.
Not your friend.
Yeah.
That was one
Which,
of a great line.
It's so not your friend. And I think the publishers, you know, they've really dropped the ball in the same way that traditional newspapers, I think, really dropped the ball. You know, these new technologies came along and they let people who care more about the technology than rather, you know, people who refer to fiction and music and, you know, what have you as content, you know, mm-hmm. they think of it as just as a sort of, you know, a filler for the code to wrap around. They let those people, you know, take it over. And so we have all kinds of very interesting information delivery systems, but not so much, you know, interesting information, you know, and, you know, we hear all the time about how, you know, newspapers are threatened. And it's true, they are threatened, and it will be a terrible thing if we lose them all. But it's their own fault because they, you know, wanted to ignore the internet, you know, and so they let these, you know, silly, you know, blogs with their content aggregation and stuff, you know, and their borrowed, you know, stories and their, you know, links and their sort of like, you know, non-trained reporters, you know, take over all these stories and, you know, instead of actually having something that's been vetted in some way, shape or form, instead you get, you know, amateurish or borrowed or, you know, what have you.
Because for this talk too, Dale, you had said part of what a writer needs to do is to realize the responsibility to the body politic in a way. Like if you're not elevating the thought in your own written work, then it's going to be for the public, it's sort of a responsibility of the writer.
I think that you have to think about, you know, what it is that you want to say, whether, you know, I mean, from a fiction point of view, whether you want to be a romance novelist or, you know, if you want to write historical swashbucklers
or literary thrillers.
Or you want to write literary thrillers, exactly. You know, what it is. I mean, you have to think about, you know, what it is you want to say, and then you have to think about how it is, you know, that you want to say it to the people that you want to say it to. And I think a lot of people forget the second half. I think a lot of people just sort of say what it is they want to say, and they let the message go out there any which way, or not go out there, as the case may be, and don't really worry about that. And I think that you're sort of, you know, you're skipping half of the equation. You know, there's this sort of a very large, very complex apparatus for publishing and talking about books nowadays. But it serves, you know, for better and worse, it serves its own interests, not the interests of the book itself. And so you've got to, you know, as a writer, you've got to be on top of that, you know, and, you know, you've got to think, oh, you know, gosh, it's really important for me to have my book on Amazon, you know, on the other hand. But on the other hand, you're thinking, am I, you know, endorsing or helping to promote a system, you know, that is killing, you know, diversity in literature, and on even a most basic level, making it ever more difficult just for writers to earn money from their books, just because of the way that they price, the way that they pay royalties and everything else, you know, with publishers.
And also, you were saying even like having to pulp the books that don't sell because
right.
the system is returned there. Yeah,
right. I mean, that's the great thing about print on demand and ebooks.
So you're not saying get rid of the artifact of the book. You can still hold a book in your hands, Dale
no.
Peck. You
yes.
can. Okay,
yes.
Let's take a short break.
Okay.
We're at the halfway mark. You've got Living Writers. Let's hear another one of Dale Peck's choices. We'll be right back.
Every day I get a brand new show off the TV, record and radio. A piece with a sleeves on. The affirmative magnolia. Now C30, C60, C90, go C30, C60, C90, go C3, go C60, C90, go C9, go 3-0, 6-0, 9-0, go. A bit bamboogie and a boogarooka. My cassette's jazz like a bazooka. Bigger, bigger, bimity bop. But I'm going down to the record shop. Yeah. Of the hits, all the big names, you get the biggest discount.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today, Dale Peck is here. And we just heard some Bow Wow Wow, Wow Wow Wow, Wow, live version.
I think it must be. I don't know that version of the song. So, that's C30, C60, C90 Go, which try to say that five times fast like she does in there. But it's a song about stealing music, which I really love. I love the song because it's a fantastic song, and it's like I think it's the first Burundi beat song is what they called it, which is, you know, a Bow Wow Wow is just a vanity project for Malcolm McLaren and all that after he left the Sex Pistols. And then Bow Wow Wow's, so Bow Wow Wow is like a rhythm section plus Annabella Lewin, the singer that he famously found in a laundromat when she was 14 and posed her naked on the cover of the record. And, you know, they sang a lot of songs about, you know, like rape and everything. She sings these songs about loving to get raped and stuff. I love Bow Wow Wow. But then the rhythm section left and became Adam and the Ants when they found Adam Ant.
Oh, and that's why that familiar beat is there.
Yes,
then.
Yes. And Boy George became famous in London by turning down Malcolm McLaren's offer to be the lead singer of Bow Wow Wow. That was what he did before Culture Club. But yes, that was their first song. It was only available on cassette, and it's about recording songs off the radio rather than buying them at the record store, which is kind of like an analog. The Dead Kennedys had a very famous album. I can't remember which album it was, but they released it on 120-minute cassette tape, and they recorded it all on one side, and they said, record your favorite album on the other side, encouraging music theft. I'm rather a big fan of, you know, piracy, I have to say.
But
that I've ever done it.
Right. What about, so for music, but what about, how does that apply to like people's books? Because you also say things like your work, writing is your work. Work is, you should get paid for.
You know, I believe both of those things, and I don't bother, you know, trying to,
looking at
I
how...
guess, reconcile them. I mean, it's you know, I do believe that, you know, writers should regard what they do in Marxist terms and think of it as, you know, something that one should contribute to society, and two, that is a way that they earn their living and they deserve to get paid for it. But at the same time, you know, I mean, not to, you know, quote a truism, but, you know, as Marshall McLuhan says, information wants to be free. And I would much rather have my books read by more people than make more money by them. Which is why, for example, you know, going back to bookstores and working in a used bookstore, you know, the only bookstore I ever worked in was a used bookstore, and I always wanted to be in a used bookstore, even though I knew I would get no money from that book. And even though, you know, it meant a few different things, but one of the things, of course, that it could mean was that someone bought your book and didn't like it. You know, I know a lot of people, especially, you know, people with not a lot of money who buy books and then they sell them so that they can afford to buy more books and all that. But, you know, I just think that, you know, used bookstores are this great, you know, circulation of you know, books at a much lower price for people who want them.
And you might find a love letter in a book.
And you might find a love letter in a book or in a copy of Carmen, etc.
Exactly.
I don't know if you have ever, you know, let's just say I've conducted an experiment, he said, putting big quotation marks. And if you go onto some of the piracy websites, it's really sort of disheartening because they don't pirate, you know, books by like ones and twos like they do albums or a dozen. They pirate them by the tens of thousands. It's just, they're just these bundles, you know.
Wait, what do you mean? I don't understand.
if you go onto a piracy website, you know, and you type in ebooks, what you'll get are 5,000 ebooks, 10,000 ebooks, my collection of 25,000 ebooks, you know, all science fiction, you know, all romance, you know, and all that.
And then
that.
Just in one fell swoop,
just
you
one
can...
fell swoop, you just
you have all
can
those
download
books.
Thousands and thousands of books, you know, because the files are so small. You know, I mean, when I look at, you know, one of my novels on my, you know, on my computer is about the equivalent of a minute of music. You know, it's 3 years of work, 300, 400 pages.
Oh, that's
and all
strange,
that,
isn't
you
it?
You know, and it takes up as much space on my computer as a minute of music, you know, or even a minute of a sound file. You know, it doesn't even have to be music. You know, music involves work, but it could just be blah, 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 blah for a minute. And, you know, it takes up, you know, the same amount of space. So, yes, everything, you know, the internet makes stealing everything easier, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, technology. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, before we forget, because we've been, you almost chose some different songs today.
I did.
Your Carolyn's?
Yes. So I think the last song is going to be Carolyn's Fingers by Cocteau Twins. And when you asked me, you know, when you emailed me and said, you know, you can pick some songs out, the very first song that popped in my head was Carolyn by The Wedding Present, which is this song. The word Carolyn is never actually said in the song, to the best of my knowledge. It's hard to understand the lyrics, but it's just one of my favorite songs of all time from one of my favorite bands and my favorite album of theirs, etc. And then I thought that I would be really clever and do all songs with the name Carol or Carolyn in the title. So I was going to do Caroline No by the Beach Boys, which is a great song, and Keith Carroll by a band called Unrest, which is a really beautiful song. And there was one other one I can't think, because I did get five. I thought maybe I would do something by Carole King too, I know, but then I decided to go for something. All the songs kind of had a sort of similar lo-fi sort of, you know, vibe to them, so I thought I would do something a little bit more varied.
Get some opera in there.
With the ones, a little opera, a little early, you know, techno house, whatever. I think that's coming up next, Africa Bambaataa.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, so yeah. Stay tuned for that
yes.
too. Well, let's also think about what's coming up next with your books, Dale. So there's another one that yes. you have in the works.
Yes. So the book of essays is coming out in spring 2015. And then ideally, it's not finished yet. Ideally, my next novel will come out a year after that. And it's a prequel to Don Quixote, which, you know, I think is about as ambitious, you know, and pretentious a project as any writer can chew off. But
what's the genesis of that? Like, how did you start?
I think the genesis is about as pedestrian as it comes. I went to Spain about 10 years ago and had never read, shamefully, had never read Don Quixote. And the Edith Grossman translation had just come out. Edith Grossman, well known for translating Garcia Marquez, is a really fantastic translator. So I bought it to read in Spain. And I, of course, asked myself how I could have never read this amazing novel before, because it is one of those classic novels that lives up to the hype, and loved it. But I was just struck by, you know, I mean, in a way, it starts off a little bit like Star Wars. You know, it just basically tells you what the story is. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, you know, some time ago in a town whose name I do not care to remember, there lived this guy. I'm not really sure what his name was. It might have been Quijada. It might have been Quixada. It might have been something like this. But anyway, he read a lot of novels of chivalry and he went crazy, you know. And, you know, he was about 50. And then we start. That's it. There we go. And I just was like, you know, I mean, you know, obviously the novel itself is what it is, but I think it's very hard for any kind of modern reader not to look at that and say, you know, if you're going to take any kind of literalist approach to this and say, okay, what kind of person goes crazy from reading books? I mean, obviously the book is a satire. You know, I mean, the sort of conception of postmodern didn't exist, you know, at that point in time. But you know, a lot of writers were very self-conscious about manipulating trends and have been, you know, throughout history. And you know, there is a self-consciousness to it, and it's not meant to be taken literally. But at the same time, of course, you know, you have to think about it literally on some level. And so I just asked myself this question, you know, what kind of person goes crazy from reading books? You know, that's sort of where this, you know, the idea for this book started, you know, to think who this might be. So.
And so is it also working within some of the constraints, like in a, like a historical time
yeah,
period
it's,
and
you know,
in Spain or
it's,
so?
I've done, you know, a ton of historical research,
then.
You know, I think with each successive book I've written, I've done more and more research. Initially I was very, you know, I was kind of much more sort of, you know, I just wanted to be in the flow and sit down and let what came out, and, you know, taking the time to sort of research things always seemed to get in the way of that. But with each successive book, I think I've been more and more interested in locating it, you know, in history more concretely. And this book is, I mean, it is definitely, it's by far the most postmodern novel that I have ever attempted to write. It's very self-conscious and plays with contemporary genres as well as 16th century genres, or really 15th century genres, because, you know, the book takes place, it's around 1465, I think. It's the year that Mary the First, who was Philip the First's wife, if you remember, Philip the First was the king who, the Spanish king who led the Armada, after Elizabeth the First turned down his proposal of marriage. He had previously been married to, I guess, her cousin, her aunt, Mary the First, not Bloody Mary or Mary Queen of Scots, and he was King of England for 3 years.
Have done a lot of research, yes. Dale.
But then she died, and he lost his, you know, title to England. And this takes place the year that he dies, and sets up the new, because before this period, the capital of Spain, which had only existed since 1492, which is one of those funny coincidences. Isabella and Ferdinand kicked off the last of the Muslims, the Moors, from the Andalusian Peninsula in 1492, 6 months before Christopher Columbus showed up and asked for some money to go on this expedition to prove that the world was round. But the kings of Spain changed the capital every monarch, because the provinces, and this is still very true of Spanish history today, the provinces of Spain are a little bit like, you know, they're a little bit like the Balkan republics. They don't love each other very much, and there was always a lot of political infighting. You know, Spain, you know, we think of Spain as this country, but, you know,
there's separatist movements.
That, so the Basques being the most famous, but, you know, Spain has six recognized languages, which I think a lot of people don't realize. But, you know, there's Catalan and there's Basque and there's Galician. And, you know, if you dare say that you speak Spanish in Spain and you're not in Castile, people will correct you and
Castellano.
Say, you speak Castilian. And I remember, you know, because I stayed in Barcelona and, you know, people would ask me, well, why did you study Spanish if you were coming to stay in Barcelona? You know, and I was like, well, I couldn't find a Catalan teacher in New York. And also,
trying my best.
Yes.
I am the ugly American here.
Also, I live in New York City where, you know, where there are a million native Spanish speakers. I thought it might be more useful for me to learn that language rather than Catalan.
A little close.
Yeah. Philip
Dale,
the First.
What I was going to ask you is, so do you think it's feeding your mind in a different way to do this research?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What you're ready for as like a human being and incorporating that into your work? Or?
Well, one of the things that I, you know, and I think maybe this is very apropos vis-a-vis living writers is, you know, when you start writing when you're very young, you don't have a lot of experience to draw from and all that. And so the writing is more immediate. But I come up with ideas and I let them germinate for decades before I finally sit down and write them. So I went to Spain 10 years ago and I wrote down some notes for this, but I didn't really commit to the book until the last couple of years. But I've been doing research for it for all that time. So it can sit there. It's not like I come up with an idea, I do an intense period of research, and then I start writing. For me, it's more like I come up with an idea and I sketch out notes for years and years.
And your subconscious has it for a while.
Yes.
Marinating or so.
You know, Martin and John and Now It's Time to Say Goodbye and The Law of Enclosures and The Garden of Lost and Found, I came up with the ideas for those four books within 12 months of each other. But the writing of them, you know, spans well over 20 years.
Let's take a short break and we'll be back to talk more today with Dale Peck on Living Writers. We'll be right back.
Satisfied, just get up, on it and ride. Give me up. But if you're looking for the perfect
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel today. Dale Peck is here. It's been a great hour so far. Thank you so much,
Thank
Dale.
You.
And that was like, wow, we've got some upbeat.
Yes. I love Afrika Bambaataa.
Dale, before you go, we have to announce that tomorrow you will be doing a reading. So you guys, everyone, you can throw this on your calendar. Thursday, October 10th. So tomorrow at 5:10 p.m., Dale Peck will be reading at the Helmut Stern Auditorium at the University of Michigan Museum of Art, UMA. Okay, so 5:10 p.m. tomorrow. And Dale, will you do a world premiere for Living Writers right now with part of your prequel to Don Quixote?
Yes, I am. He said, looking, suddenly second-guessing what he thought he would read before.
No. Am I strong-arming you?
No, not at all. Okay, I think this will work.
World premiere.
So this is the prologue to the prologue, as it were, that my editor has already told me he thinks I should cut. But we'll try it anywhere. It's chapter zero, before the before, or a beginning is sometimes a muddle. We all start from nothing, but sometimes that nothing is something. Such a zero discovered independently by Babylonians, Chinese, Greeks, Hindus, and Mayans, but named by the Persian mathematician Al-Khwarizmi in the year of the Hijra 209. It was his cipher via the Zefirum of Fibonacci that became the Italian Zefiro, and thus the Venetian zero we use today. Such, too, is literary invention, whose individual iterations can neither escape from nor lay claim to the thousands of years of storytelling that precede them. We know that children owe half their physical being to the father and half to the mother, yet from the moment of conception they are unique, and if sometimes they favor one or to other or both parents, it is equally possible that they will bear no resemblance to either other than that which is mandated by species. That said, they will probably look like their parents. Yes, and even the most startlingly original work of literature is dependent for its existence upon every text that appeared in the millennia prior to its creation, but especially so on those that have appeared in the years immediately preceding it, while the most methodical sequel conceived concurrently with its predecessor and drawn from the same inkwell exists as a distinct entity from the book that came before. By the second part of this proposition, we are less likely to be troubled, for we understand that each book begins with its first word and ends with its last, and such associations as these words have with ones that have been printed before exist because the author made them apparent by means of citation, allusion, or other deliberate echo. But it is for this same reason that the first part of our proposition is also true. For language is inherently collective and inescapably literary. The words that mothers and fathers teach their sons and daughters have been shaped over the course of thousands of years by psalmists, by poets and playwrights and novelists whose narratives are elaborated into ethics and whose characters diffuse into cultural aspirations, yes, and whose metaphors are the basis of representation and logic, and whose turns of phrase become idiomatic. To believe otherwise would be, well, quixotic. How do you say that word? For the spoken word follows from the written like the flower from the stalk and the stalk from the seed. Yes, and the seed follows from the flower, and so we are left asking which came first, flower or seed. The question is the answer. And so what we call learning to speak is also learning to read. Yes, and it is also learning to think, for it is these first words, cooed, sung, whispered, and screamed at us in our infancy, that give shape to the impressions collected by our senses, which only latterly coalesce into something we might call thought, let alone consciousness or character. And so learning to speak is also learning to be. And so anyone who can speak is made by literature in the deepest part of his or her being. An illiterate fisherman or unlettered washerwoman is no less indebted to the works of Homer, Ovid, and the Thousand Nights and One Night than is the most bookish author or bibliomaniac. And so I say that the hero of this tale, who shares a name and certain other traits with the protagonist of the most celebrated novel in Christendom, is mine and is no more based on that character than the man who went out on the third sally is based on the one who went out on the first two, by which I mean that he is wholly based on him. But he is not him. Homage only truly succeeds by flailing, as Sancho might have put it. There will be more to say about the previous appearances of our hero, about the various authors who have claimed some share in his prominence, and the convoluted path by which this, the missing first third of the history of the last and best of all knights errant, has finally come to light. For now, just know that the events recounted in this history are every bit as true as the ones that were narrated in those other books. It is only the telling that lies.
thanks, Dale.
You're welcome.
Wow, the crowd goes wild. World premiere. Prequel to Don Quixote.
Vote on whether or not it should stay in the book.
It sounds like a manifesto.
I tend to be a little bombastic.
Because it seems like you're saying this is how it will be and why in some ways.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I just don't think that you can even tackle any kind of, you know, work that relates to a work as great as Don Quixote without trying to say why you're doing it. You know, it's too big a project. You know, I mean, there are just some, you know, books that are monuments, and Don Quixote is definitely one, you know, if not the biggest of them.
It's wonderful how you also are saying this is chapter zero or precede zero, because since you're already, you know, inhabiting and playing with the prequel idea as well. Is that going to be that's the working title, or are you just going to say prequel to Don Quixote?
The working title is Young Don Quixote, which I find to be a terribly dull title. But, you know, it's just one of those things. Martin and John came about because I just kept referring to the manuscript as the Martin and John stories, and then Martin and John, you know, and it's the world's most dull title, and a lot of people, including David Halperin, know it by another name.
Well, we can't say what the English, the British title.
Effing Martin, let us say, which is the name of one of the short stories that is obviously a much more exciting title. But if I'm being completely honest, the title I came up with was the dull one. And it was simply, you know, Ditto Drift House, one of my young adult books. You know, it originally was called The House That Got Stuck on the Island of the Past. But the house is called Drift House, and I just kept referring to it as Drift House, and so Drift House is eventually what it became.
How did you decide to write these young adult or these like middle grade books, Dale?
Oddly enough, it was 9/11. Right after 9/11, I went to stay with a friend on Cape Cod in a house that had been built by his grandfather, who was a shipbuilder, and the house resembled a ship. And he woke up the following morning after possibly smoking an illegal, you know, drug, for which the possession of is only a misdemeanor. I did not partake, I will say. And he said, I had the strangest dream that the house floated out to sea. And I immediately saw this story, and I also immediately thought of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, in which the Bevensey kids are sent out of London because of the Blitz. And so Drift House has three children who are sent out of New York City because of 9/11, and who go to stay with their uncle in a funny old house that floats out onto the Sea of Time.
Yes, the Sea of Time, yes. Which reminded me of the Phantom Tollbooth somehow.
Oh, God, it's been so long since I've read the Phantom Tollbooth. I loved it when I was a kid. You never know with children's books that when you write them as an adult, especially if you don't have kids and you haven't read children's literature for a long time, what's coming back and shaping things. Like somebody pointed out, you know, the name Murray is the name of one of the kids in A Wrinkle in Time, which I hadn't thought about. Charles Murray, right? Is the boy's name?
That sounds.
Charles and Murray are the two brothers' names in the book. And
Shout out to Madeline Alingal.
That's a great book. It's such a wonderful book.
Oh yes. And so you just decided, you thought, I feel like writing the story.
I'll do it. I mean, I started, you know, working on the books. I had just signed with a new agent at the time, but also the Hatchet Jobs controversy had just happened. And I would send books out.
Is that about like the moment, like the Rick Moody first line, or is it the actual collection when it came out, when it was published together?
This would be 2003, so it was just really about, it was before the book itself had come out.
So it was about the essay.
It was just about the essay.
In the New Republic,
yes.
Was it? And then later on, you got a pie.
Yes, well, that
face.
At a fundraiser. That was when Rick and I, you know, I mean, we spoke beforehand. It was actually the first time we'd spoken, but, you know, Rick and I talked before then. We've actually done an event together since, a Thomas Bernhardt event. We're both big fans of Thomas Bernhardt.
Yes.
And,
yes.
You know, as I said to him, and, you know, I've said other times, I mean, I never would have written that review if I thought that it would have become the thing it was, only because I felt like it was extremely hurtful to him. And I have nothing against Rick Moody. I don't know him. I had never met him, or maybe I met one time in passing or something like that. And I thought that the way that it was blown up, it was obviously hurtful to me, but you have to take those lumps as a writer. But what they did to him, I thought was very unfair. You know, we discussed all that, and, you know, he's a mighty white dude. He was very stand up, you know. He threw pie in my face, and we raised some money for a writing colony in India. So, yeah, that was fun.
So that was, so that's that.
That was that.
That's
yes.
that. And so, but around this time you were thinking, you know,
oh, well,
you
around
kind
this
of
time I was
the
trying to sell this book, The Garden of Lost and Found, and I would send the manuscript out and people would send it back saying, we can't publish a book by Dale Peck. Nobody likes him. So, or they would say Dale Peck is a terrible writer, even though they'd loved my first three books. So I sent the manuscript out for Drifthouse under a pseudonym. And everybody bid on it, you know. And then afterwards, we decided to publish it under my name. But we circulated the manuscript under an assumed name.
That's interesting.
Yeah, just so that to see, you know, if you know people were judging, you know, me based on my reputation rather than, you know, on the actual writing in front of them, and you know, based on, you know, the amount of money I got for the book, I'm going to say that they had been previously judging me based on my reputation and not the writing I was doing. So.
It seems like you want the best for writing and writers, Dale. Like, even if some of, like, maybe you wouldn't say that first line again if you had to do it again. Maybe you would. I don't know. But it seems like in your, like your, what you want is for literature to make a difference in the world and in people's lives.
I love literature, and I definitely think that, you know, like a lot of things, you know, if you love them, you should fight for them, and you should definitely fight against the people who are maybe cheapening them. And, you know, it's like we started with, we're talking about a literary thriller. I think that just putting, you know, slapping that on a book to try to make the book sound more important diminishes literature, you know, and all that. You should, you know, literature is a serious thing, and especially what, you know, it's an art form that anybody can do, anybody can write. And so, you know, you've got to argue and say why this is literature and this is popular fiction and this is just a diary, you know, and all that. I mean, it takes passion. So, and I guess I've always been a kind of tough love kind of person, you know. So, yes, I'm often a little blunt about it, but I do want the best for literature and for writers, you know, certainly.
Dale, thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having
me.
This
has been great.
Thank you.
It's been great. Come back anytime, okay?
I will do.
Okay. So everyone, you've been listening to Living Writers. Dale Peck has been on the program today. You can hear him read tomorrow. What are you going to read tomorrow, Dale? Like, is it, or
I think I'm going to read from Visions and Revisions, okay. the essays.
So from Visions and Revisions, another new book of Dale Peck's. So 5:10 at the Art Museum. Thanks to Greg for engineering. Thanks to all you out there for listening. Until next time, I'm T. Hetzel.
Is it recording? Hello, this is Daniel Johnston. You're listening to WCBN FM ANNARBOR. Radio, 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 rock and roll!
Sports Report.
Puts it around the boards. Hensick is there. Puts it out in front. Shot attempt by Turnbull. He scores! Travis Turnbull took a bouncing puck in front and knocks it in the net. Wolverines extend that lead. It's now 3-1. Eight seconds left to go. He will dump it into neutral ice. 5 seconds left to go. Hensick gets the puck, sends it all the way in over the goal, and time is going to expire.